Oh, I really like that episode.
Yeah. It reminded you of me.
Just, you know, I just, there was a lot of, just a lot of overlap to my personal life, you know? So.
Okay. No, that, no, the joke is about me being the smart one.
I understood it because I'm a genius. I just.
God.
Oh, I'm so angry. Welcome to Obscurity, the podcast about obscure subcultures. I'm Jordan.
And I'm Brenna. And today we're talking about child prodigies.
Like me.
Were you in any advanced classes as a kid?
Yes, many.
Go on, tell me about them. And what I'm most curious about is, like, do you think they impacted you socially at all? And if so, how?
In elementary school, I was put into, it was a advanced class, like, for fourth and fifth graders, basically. So it was, rather than be part of your normal fourth grade class, I was put into this class that had fifth graders as well.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like learning a grade up. And then the fifth graders were also learning up like a grade up to sixth grade, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you kind of got exposed. It was kind of like a double advancement class. And then next year I was on the fifth grade side of that. So, I think I don't really understand why they didn't just have my school didn't just have a, like, 1 year ahead kind of class, you know, but rather than the kind of this weird split thing. But, I was in that. And then in high school, I took a lot of AP classes, if that's what you're referring to. But
was, like, in the fifth grade or whenever you did the advanced math, was that the first time you were pulled out of class to do something advanced or to start, like, in kindergarten?
So it wasn't advanced. I didn't have different classes yet, right? It was still elementary school, so you still had, like, one teacher all day.
Right, right.
So it was, like, all subjects were advanced. I definitely was given, like, for reading stuff, I was usually given higher reading level stuff than, like, my classmates. I don't think that's probably true for math. I don't remember, but I doubt that would have been the case for math. But I was definitely, like, you know, I was reading a higher level than most of my classmates in my younger grades. So, they would typically give me more challenging books from that perspective, I guess. I don't know. It's a long time ago.
What about the second part of my question? Do you think that impacted you socially at all? And if so, how?
I don't know. Like, it's hard for me to tell that, like, I think what you're alluding to is that I am a socially awkward nerd. Is that what you're trying to get to?
Oh, if that was subtle, that was not my intention. That should have been very much explicit. Much more overt.
Yeah. I don't know. It's hard for me to tell how much of that my personality, especially growing up when I was definitely more, I think, shy and socially awkward than I am even now.
You're still socially
extremely
awkward.
I don't know how much of that was because I was, you know, in a slightly higher level of whatever education, you know. I also went, frankly, to I went to a very good school, right? Like,
you grew up in a posh neighborhood.
I grew up in a very I grew up in white flight suburbia where there was a lot of money and we had very good schools. One of the best, if not at the time, the best school district in the state. Right. So I, you know, even for when you weren't in an advanced class, you were getting a very good education and it was kind of expected. Right. Like there was a lot of expectations around that. So I don't know how much of that really would have impacted my socialness versus just what I was as a shy, awkward kid growing up.
Would you believe if I told you I too was in advanced reading and math classes from a very young age?
I would not.
He says as he nods along. I would see, this is where you're supposed to reciprocate and ask me. And so I can tell you all about how I was, you know, a gifted student and I would get pulled out and I would go into higher level math classes. And
oh, so they did have math in Maine.
good one. Good one. All our international listeners, Maine is a... How would you describe Maine as a state of
the
state you've ever been to?
The backwoods of America that is largely responsible for the fall of Roe v. Wade thanks to their Senator Susan Collins.
Damn it. Actually, I was going to say, no, we're like a bluish state, generally speaking. But yeah, we do keep going with Susan.
Yeah.
Oh, Susan.
That one's on you guys.
That old bag. I did meet Susan, though, when I was young. Fun fact, did I ever tell you I won a National Geographic contest?
Yeah, you have told me this. I think you've told this podcast, but you can tell it again.
Really? No, I won a National Geographic contest when I was 10 years old about writing why Maine was the greatest state.
Yeah, you've definitely told on this podcast.
Yes. Anyway, back to the
And they felt bad. They were like, well, this poor girl thinks Maine's the greatest state. Let's just give her the win.
Honestly, like that might have been it. And they're like, look at that picture of her. How awkward.
Yeah.
We'll give her something. It's the only thing she'll have to look forward to in life.
So you were in advanced classes.
Mm-hmm.
And they did affect you socially?
No. I mean, I'm sure they did some way, some they didn't. But I just really wanted to take that opportunity to pat myself on the back and say, I too was a smart kid.
Do you think it helped you though? I feel like in a lot of ways, like one thing that a lot of parenting literature says these days is you don't want to tell your kid they're smart.
Oh, it's so tough, right?
Yeah.
Because it's a double-edged sword, right? Because you don't want to stifle their learning, but at the same time, if you're putting that pressure on them, it almost immediately like ostracizes them and or puts an undue pressure on them. Is that why?
It's a little of that, but it's more that telling kids that they're smart teaches them to be extremely lazy from an educational aspect.
Hmm.
So, and I found that to be true, not to imply that I'm a genius or smarter,
which you aren't,
smarter than the average bear. But my point is that a lot of, you know, when you are told and reinforced that you are really smart, oh, look how smart you are. You're doing so great. Like, oh, you're reading at a higher level, whatever it might be. Right. You learn that you don't need to spend a lot of effort. Right. It kind of, there's like this natural tendency. And at some point you're just kind of above your peers. And what happens is then you get to the parts where you're not anymore. You're doing something that's more challenging that actually requires effort and work to study, to learn, to educate yourself. And you don't have that practice and those muscles in order to do that very well. And so there's like this trend where that people see where those kids start to fall off, where they're intelligent, but they don't have the know-how of like, how to learn, right?
That's interesting. I never thought of that, but I think you're hitting the nail on the head because that kind of does ring true for me. Because I think I very much coasted in a lot of ways.
Yeah, exactly. Coasting, that's a good word, but yeah.
I would rely on like memorize. I could, study the night before, cram the night before, and still get an A. And I know a lot of people will like procrastinate and study the night before and not have it manifest in an A. And to me, that was usually quite easy, even into college. And I was actually thinking, as I was taking notes for this episode, I think I've become smarter as an adult in that so much of what I learned in college, I just didn't care, right? Like it was all about get the good grades so you could get a good job and I could get good grades by, studying last minute. And I wish I could go back and learn certain subjects with the intention of learning rather than just I have to pass this, which I think is part of that is inherently how school is structured. That's part of it too. But it's kind of surprised me at work, like as I've progressed in my career, I don't know, I think the stuff you learn, right? Like college is basically supposed to prove to a potential employer that you are capable of learning, right?
Yeah.
And because anything you learn on
or
the job,
you've learned the skills, but yeah.
Right. With the exception of like something specialized, like being a doctor where you have to come in with a specific skill set and knowledge base, like so much of especially corporate America is going to be on the job training. And I've really learned how to learn. And I think I've had to develop a lot of skills in the working environment because I did rely so much on
natural aptitude. Right?
Yeah.
They say like parenting stuff says, now it's not, you don't tell your kid you're really smart. You say, oh, it looks like you worked really hard for that. Yeah. You start rewarding the effort. So that even when, and it's not just like say you didn't try very hard and you did great that you shouldn't like still be proud of them. Right. But it's to say like the value is when you do put the effort in, for something difficult, that's something to be appreciated versus just you're being rewarded or you're being appreciated or whatever else just because you naturally are you know, talented at it at this phase, right? Because it's not always going to be true.
Yeah.
Right. And that's where that fall off happens. I definitely like coasted for a very long time until I got into, like, for me, high level math, especially when it becomes like theoretical math and it requires visualization, as it turns out, or like some understanding of that kind of thing. Right. That became very difficult for me in high school. And I had no idea how to like sit down and study. Cause before that, like geometry, arithmetic, all that stuff, it was nothing for me.
Yeah.
You know, like it required no effort. And anything on more of the liberal arts side of it, the literature side, like continued to. And I was lazy and I would write a 20 page paper the night before and I would get an A.
Yeah. Right? Yep.
Like, and so then it went again to work situations where I have to do something that's a little outside of my comfort zone. You're right. I had to relearn how to do that in a way that actually, you know, I had to relearn to do that, and it was challenging to like figure out how to build those muscles up.
Yeah, 100%. So that is a long way of getting to our topic, which I will tease out just a little bit more by quoting from a Vice article.
Love Vice.
As a child, did you ever chew on and swallow soil, or drop a chocolate digestive into a glass of milk and then scoop the mush out with your entire hand and eat it, or take literally any tests and get less than a 97%? Yes? Well, then you probably weren't a child genius. Then you know that already, because this morning you tripped over your own foot while on your way to your job, which is not neuroscience at King's College. So can you guess what our topic is today?
People who think they're smart but aren't.
Child prodigies.
Yeah.
Child prodigies.
Oh, that's interesting. I want to know more, because I know I have somebody who in mind who I think is a genius. And I'm curious like how his experience compares to like child prodigy, because I didn't know him as like a young child. And so I'm curious like I want to hear.
Is this someone you work with?
No, this is a friend that I made later in like middle school, high school. He ended up being, he has a double doctorate in neurobiology and neurobiology and Fox. Yeah,
rocket stupid. Science or
yeah,
something.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so like he's an extremely talented guitar player. He's like a master chef. Like the guy can do it all. And so I'm just curious, like, how his experience where he's on the other end of it, like the end of this cycle that's kind of proving out to me his genius versus what people start at.
Well, that's actually a very interesting question you posed, because there is an actual distinction between a child prodigy and a genius. I won't get into that right now, but we will get into that later. So just to start, basic definition, a child prodigy per Wikipedia is defined as a person under the age of 10 who produces meaningful output in some domain to the level of an adult expert. And the term is also applied more broadly to young people who are extraordinarily talented in some field.
Hmm.
So this is one thing that a lot of the articles reiterated when you get into the science behind a child prodigy, is that data is actually still incredibly thin, because we don't have necessarily like a consistent definition. Even that definition I read is very vague, right? Like, how do you define expert? Don't have
what's
like
that metric. Yeah.
Yeah. What's that metric? And then, so the sample size is already small that we know of. And then you look at those kids, and do all of them get identified? And then even from there, how do you get to study them? You don't really. It's very hard to, because they're busy doing other things. So in one article I was reading, they said, you know, we really only have good long-term data on about 50 child prodigies. So it's still incredibly in its infancy, I guess, in terms of research, even though I think we have a good broad definition of what a child prodigy is.
So like when you say long-term data, as in like tracking them from the point where they're identified as a child prodigy basically through adulthood? And
yes.
Okay, got it.
Yes. And like also more the science behind their brain, and
right,
makes them operate differently,
right? Why are they the end of the bell curve?
Yes. So basically there are two key scientific things that tend to be hallmarks of child prodigies. The first one is a high-performing, long-term working memory, or LTWM. So in particular, like math prodigies, they've done PET scans on kids, and it's basically, yeah, they have these long-term working memories, and memory specific to a field of expertise is capable of holding, you know, relevant information for extended periods, usually for hours. And the analogy one article drew is that, you know, think about an experienced waiter. They can hold the orders of up to 20 customers in their heads while they serve them, but they're only going to be as good as an average person in, say, like a number sequence pattern. So that in and of itself is a result of experience. But to that end, a child prodigy, that long-term memory is going to come naturally in certain fields.
This is super interesting. Naturally, I'm going to talk about myself. But I had a conversation with a friend recently, and we were, as usual, talking about aphantasia, because what we kind of determined was that he is hyperphantasia.
Yeah.
Right, which is the amount of times we talk about aphantasia on this podcast. In case you're a new listener, I can't visualize him. I don't have a third eye. Mind's eye, that's the one. Or third eye. I don't have a mind's eye. I can't visualize things in my imagination. But he's the opposite, right? He has such a vivid visualization ability that, like, he can, when he memorizes a sequence of numbers, and this is why I was thinking about the waiter thing, like, for him, he literally can, like, see the numbers written on a piece of paper. And so it's like he's reading them in his mind off that piece of paper. Whereas for me, like, memorizing a sequence is not at all like that. It's just, I have a list of numbers in my head. I'm not looking at them. You know right. What I mean?
And to some end, I kind of wonder, you know, you're both on the extreme ends, right? Like, I'm somewhere in the middle. Like, if I were to describe how I see things, sometimes it's like a flash and I can't hold it there. Yeah. Sometimes I do. I literally, if I'm trying to think of how to spell a word, sometimes I can close my eyes and like see it in a book and write it out. Sometimes I can't. Like, I think I'm kind of in that average, in that middle ground.
More in the middle, yeah.
And I've always kind of wondered, I feel like the aphantasia can be both a benefit and a negative in terms of memory. Like, on one hand, I think you could argue that, yeah, so if you can't use your visual, like a visual memory to stimulate something, that could make it harder to remember something. Conversely, I wonder if that's why you can remember a lot of things, because you don't have images intertwined with your memory of facts, so you have less floating around in there that you have to keep track of. I think it could probably go either way. It's probably very circumstantial, but
why I was coming up is because there is like some of the like aphantasia stuff I research, you know, or pay attention to. Like, there's a lot about memory, because a lot of memory is visual, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm like, all of this about the child prodigies, like, what I'm wondering is, like, well, one thing like research shows by aphantasia is that a lot of them have very poor, I can't remember the like scientific word for it, but it's like I can't remember, but it's like personal memory recollection, right?
Okay.
Like, and I find that true for myself. Like, I don't remember facts of my life, right? But like my childhood, I think I have more gaps in that memory than I think your typical person does, just based on the way people talk about like their experiences growing up, right? And but like what I'm curious is from like, and I doubt this is in research, but like where my mind is going is for these child prodigies who have the ability to memorize these things or remember things or have better memory for certain subjects, right? Like, I wonder how much that, like, what their brain makeup looks like from like, hey, is it really a visual memory for them? Is it what is allowing them to think or memorize that stuff so differently than the average person?
Well, don't knock my research skills, Jordan, because that did come up in my
research. Oh, really?
Yes. They study, like, again, during PET scans, looking at a child math prodigy. And basically what the PET scan revealed is that the areas of the brain that would light up when he was doing math, are the areas of the brain that deal in visual and spatial memory, as well as visual mental imagery. But again, that is just one example, and they don't have enough. Again, there's not enough data around, you know, do they have a thicker gray matter, a thinner gray matter? Like, how do all the areas of the brain work together?
Oh, that's super interesting, though.
At least for some examples, yes, the part of the brain that gets activated is the same part of the brain that's responsible for visual, spatial memory and mental imagery.
Well, that explains why I'm not a child prodigy in math.
Probably. And it was so funny because it says for this kid that they studied, it said that other areas of the brain showed use by the subject, including a sector of the brain generally related to childlike finger counting, probably used in his mind to relate numbers to the visual cortex.
That's interesting. Yeah, this is fascinating.
Yeah. And then this kid, which I thought was also really cool, is he never excelled in math at itself, but how he became a child prodigy in the mathematics field was he taught himself algorithms and tricks for calculatory speed. So he became capable of extremely complex mental math.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that like really like, it's like that shortcut, kind of like what you're saying, that he's teaching himself a shortcut more so than the math. It's, I mean, it is the math, but there's a shortcut to how he figures out like a pattern pretty much.
Is that like how, I mean, oversimplifying it, but like if you're trying to do like 12 times 11 or something, right? It's like you can just do 10 times 11, then 12 times 1, kind of like that kind of thing.
I would think so. Something along those lines. And then so in terms of the working memory, I'll read again from another article. But, you know, it's, they say it's relatively easy to test for working memory capacity. And one common way to measure it is by seeing how many items someone can remember simultaneously for a short period. If you're given two 10-digit phone numbers and can repeat them back, you have a higher working memory capacity than someone who can recall only 7 digits of one phone number. And I want to go on a complete tangent here. I don't think I've mentioned it a ton on this podcast, but, you know, I am a huge fan of Survivor, like huge fan.
I didn't know that.
And there was one season, one episode, like where one of their physical challenges was basically they had to, you know, go over all of these obstacles and, you know, they're emaciated. They haven't eaten. They have to go over all these obstacles. They get to, I think, like a table and there's they have to solve a puzzle, which gives them a sequence of, I think, 14 or 15 numbers. Mm-hmm. And they had to memorize all those numbers and then go back through the obstacle and place those numbers in order on their table. So most people are going back and forth, and they can't get it and they're back and forth and they're going out for the fourth time. And there's one guy who is arguably probably a genius. He's wicked smart. He's out there for what feels...
That's the most Boston thing you've ever said.
Wicked smart.
Wicked smart.
He's out there for what seems like an eternity, but he's... Everyone else has come back multiple times. He finally comes back and he gets it on his first try. And what I distinctly remember him telling Jeff Probst, the host of Survivor, is that he memorized it as, I think, two separate phone numbers because he has learned that the reason, and I don't know how true this is, but he seems smart enough. It was mentioned here. The reason phone numbers are no more than 7 digits, generally speaking, is like because that's the optimal number of digits people can remember. So he did some sort of like, I think, visual imagery in his mind, like assigning a number to a letter or to an image or something or other. But that's how he did it, was memorizing it in the turn, like the sequence of phone numbers. And that has always stuck with me, that so that when I go on Survivor and eventually win it and become a millionaire, I too can use that that trick.
That's interesting. I struggle though, like, because that's like a very specific factor, right? Like to numbers, right? Like to have that working memory of two sets of 7 or 10 digit numbers or whatever, right?
Like, but it's also like, I mean, you're looking at averages. Like that doesn't say much about what the brain is capable of, but I'm sure there's an average of like, it's tested based on people, like you give them up to 8 digits and that's where the most people start to decline.
Yeah, what I mean more is that like, it's clearly a good test of like that working memory, but from like, I think about, and I just trying to think about like, how does it, does the, are there different applications that work differently for people? You know what I mean? So like, I would think that I would handle that pretty poorly. Like, if I think about myself personally, I'm not a genius, so I know that, like, that's not what I'm trying to say. But I would think like two sets of numbers would be challenging for me to keep in my working memory. On the other hand, I'm going to take it back to last episode where I mentioned that you are a big, big role-playing fan.
Thanks. Thanks for bringing that one up again.
But like when I have game mastered a role-playing game, right? And we've had 7 or 8 people at the table sometimes, right? And everyone's doing their own thing. I don't have a visual visualization. I'm not taking notes most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a good understanding of where all 8 of those people are in the scene, what they're doing. And I'm cutting back, like, as Game Master, it's my job to make sure everyone is getting a fair turn and everything else, right?
Yeah.
So, like, for me, that has never been a struggle. Like, I can cut back and forth and have total knowledge of what's happening in 8 different things simultaneously and enough facts about the individual scenes that each of those 8 people are in that I can kind of switch between them. So like, I know it's kind of a weird comparison, but it's like, I'm curious, like, again, like this just makes me think like, why is it that I'm able to do that, but I can't keep 20 numbers in my head, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, I think, yeah, they're different, like,
it's just different, because you're an application, yeah.
Yeah, and I think a child prodigy, like, math is a frequent subject in which you see prodigies, but... Right.
It's also probably measured more in that sense, yeah.
It's measured more, and it's not the only place someone can be a prodigy. Like, you can be a prodigy in one subject, but not another.
So, would you say I'm a prodigy in Call of Cthulhu, the role-playing game?
I would say you are a prodigy in being a pain in my ass.
Yeah, that's fair.
So... we covered, you know, one of the hallmarks, which is the long-term memory. And then the second thing that is really a key indicator of child prodigy is this concept called rage to master, which is the unstoppable motivation to excel in one's domain of ability. And it's really such a critical part of being a child prodigy because basically, like... being a child prodigy, it's finite, right? They will eventually not be a child, and they'll hit the limit of their ability, and they'll eventually be like, they'll hit this point of mastery as an adult, and that's when other people can start to catch up to them, right? Like, I mean, you're only a prodigy for as long as you're above the curve, and then at a certain point, like I told you, I think I've gotten smarter in adulthood in the working world. Like, I think I have more of a capacity to learn, and if I was intentional about it, I think I could go out and master some, you know, pretty much any subject, not any subject, but within reason. Don't smirk at me. I think I could.
I'm just thinking of Brenna, the rocket scientist.
I could be.
Orbital dynamics, Brenna's specialty.
Oral dynamics?
Orbital, not oral.
What? Wait, what's orbital dynamics?
Yeah, you're a real genius.
I am not a prodigy nor a genius. So obviously, like, even as we've talked about, the definition of giftedness can vary across the world, but researchers really agree that the common denominators include, you know, extreme curiosity and an intense urge to discover. And Susan G. Suline, who directs the University of Iowa's Belin Blank Center, a leading research center focusing on gifted education, says that, quote, "Truly gifted kids are almost always autodidacts, motivated from within. Sometimes there's something holding them back from expressing it, such as boredom as autism," she says. "But on the inside, these..." and this is where I apparently didn't copy and paste the
full quote.
the full quote. That is apparently where I fucked that up. "But on the inside, kids are smart, something or other." And then...
Paraphrase.
Well, I'm sure I said it. I did as much justice to it as I could. Side note, and I don't have much more on this, but recent research does suggest that there is a genetic connection between autism and prodigiousness, which doesn't surprise me because, like, autistic people I have known, again, anecdotal, limited.
Yeah, there's a lot of anecdotally.
For sure. Like, there is a correlation, and the science, like, still is yet to be finalized as to what specifically in someone's brain kind of causes that.
So I know you kind of went over like the general definition of how we determine someone's a prodigy, but I was struck by the quote that, you know, they often are curious, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that totally rings true, right? Like, someone who is knowledgeable tends to be someone who is curious about knowledge and wants to absorb that knowledge, right?
Yeah.
And likes to ask things. What I'm curious about, though, is like there's often a distinction between intelligence and knowledge, mm-hmm. in that one is about, it's almost like intelligence is kind of about your ability to think through a situation, right? Or to problem solve or whatever else. Like it's your ability to create a solution out of nothing versus knowledge, which is like your personal encyclopedia of data inside your head, right? And so I'm curious, like how, like when they measure, when they're talking about prodigies, like how much of it is about they just know a lot of things versus the intelligence, which is kind of like what you were talking about with that boy who has his algorithm, math algorithm, right? That's an intelligent solution. He doesn't know every math, the answer to every mathematical problem. He has created ways for his brain to more quickly solve them, which, you know what I mean?
I think that's a good question, and I don't really have an answer, but I think this is a good time to circle around to that distinction between adult genius and child prodigy. So a child prodigy is someone who is very precocious in a certain field, and they master a domain that has already been invented. A genius is someone who revolutionizes a field of knowledge.
This is the Einstein verse. Yeah, okay.
Exactly. And so you have, I think, Mozart is an example of someone who was both. He was a child prodigy. He like started playing music at a very young age, and then he revolutionized the field. So he was both. But for a lot of people, the prodigiousness, like it drops off kind of like once you're an adult, and or doesn't drops off isn't necessarily the right word. Many prodigies go on to become extremely successful, like professors, doctors, what have you.
But you're not groundbreaking. You're not creating. Yeah, you're not breaking ground in the field.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The other thing I'll say is really going back to that thirst to learn. So Lynn Kendall, a psychologist and gifted child consultant for the British Association of Mensa, said, you know, exceptional kids process things quickly, have a good memory, are more attentive to what's happening around them, and they have a thirst to learn, which she says parents find it difficult to keep up with, which is interesting because they really are. They're going to be asking so many questions that it's actually exhausting. And I think of like the typical three-year-old is like, but why? But why? Yeah. But why? And just imagine that, you know, intensified by like 20.
So one of my favorite books and by one of my favorite authors, by one of my favorite people, a.k.a. Ken Jennings. and this is also like probably spoilers because I'm definitely going to do an episode on Jeopardy contestants at some point. But like he in his book about his experiences on Jeopardy, right? Like he relates it. It's not just about like his winning streak. He also goes generally into like the world of trivia and all this stuff. And he kind of addresses the question of like, how does someone learn that much trivia, right? Like, how can you become so smart to do that? And he talks a lot of it's very, he kind of circles around this exact stuff, which is like his point that he makes is he doesn't consider himself more intelligent than an average person. He just considers himself more curious.
Yeah.
he doesn't think that, especially trivia, right? Like trivia, literally in its name, it is trivial knowledge, yeah. right? Yeah. It's not necessarily important stuff, but the point is he's very curious about the world. So he likes to learn these things and absorbs it really well because of that curiosity and that, you know, that translated very well for him in terms of a lucrative game show career. But I've always found that a really kind of fascinating way of thinking about it, which is like intelligence isn't something, and again, to intelligence knowledge kind of dynamic, but it's not just something that you're naturally good at, something that you have to have that in inherent innate curiosity in order to build up that like that knowledge repertoire, right?
Yeah, I have kind of two anecdotes that reminds me of. Like one, take it back to a work example where I said, you know, I feel like I've become smarter in my adulthood because I've been in the same company and mastered a couple fields.
Yeah,
but one reason I did so well, especially my first job in finance, like I remember there would be production issues of something would go wrong. It would cause numbers to fuck up. And so many people just like, all right, well, let's fix it and move on.
And that was a scientific definition. Things are fucked up.
Things are fucked up. I was always like, well, why?
Right.
Like before learning about like, you know, root cause problem solving RCA, or what yeah. have you. I just wanted to know why, yeah. because why did this happen? And it made me really good at that job because I wanted to dig in, understand. And as a result, as like I had that natural curiosity to understand why something went wrong, you learn kind of the nuts and the bolts.
Yep.
And then separately, I read, like, I've always been a big like news reader, Reddit reader, like whatever, like random stuff. Obscure subcultures have right. always intrigued me.
Yep.
But I wouldn't really remember a lot of things because I read an article once, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then if I never hear about that topic again, then I don't, like, it's going to leave my mind. But yeah. I will say, since starting this podcast, I think it's A, improved my memory probably a little bit, but also because I'm talking about something at length, because for the topics I research, I've, you know, read more than a singular article right. and I've, you know, it hits that curiosity thing, yeah. right? Like, and it's made me, I think I could probably recite quite a bit of detail from every single topic we've had.
Yeah, same. And not just the ones that I think I have the notes on, right? Like,
right.
We definitely have that recall from that.
Ooh, we should quiz each other on each other's old topics. Like, yeah. maybe when we get to episode 100, we should do a little.
Well, what we'll discover is which ones we really didn't care for.
Yeah. Reggae.
Yeah, right, exactly. We're going to talk about Swedish hot rods and see how much you retained of that.
Yeah. But the other thing that you kind of alluded to this is that whole nature versus nurture thing. And Ken Jennings say, like, he thinks anyone can.
Well, yeah. And I don't know that he said that explicitly. I think he was just trying to downplay, like,
his intelligence.
He was trying to be modest, I think, and point out that, like, for him, it was the way he sees himself is it's through this lens of curiosity versus this lens of raw aptitude. But
yeah.
But I think I know where you're going with this. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, jury's still out. Like, some experts think that, like, prodigies are born with those talents, and others think that, like, given enough support and instruction, any individual can gain expertise in a specific skill.
I don't believe that.
Well, I think it's a mix of both. Yeah. Like, I think, like basketball, I remember, like, you have the LeBron Jameses of the world, right? Who are just, that is a complete nature thing, just born a natural born athlete.
And are you saying that I could not compete with LeBron James if I gave myself enough time and effort and training? I'm 5'7" and 35 years old, Brenna.
I
could take him.
moving on. But I remember, you know, basketball camp or something, a coach saying, like, most people are not like that. Of course, you're going to have the exception to the rule, the raw talents who are just born incredible players. But for a lot of people, and most people, the other greats out there, like maybe Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, Allen Iverson, those people had some talent. But the reason they're out there is because they practice every single fucking day over and over for hours. And they got the free throw down. They got, you know, the three pointer down, whatever that shot was. And it's like, so for any of you here, like, you know, not anyone can do it, right? Like, some people are just not going to have the hand-eye coordination. You have to have some sort of, like, baseline, I would think, aptitude and physical ability.
And physique.
But sure, like, a little bit. But, like, I think
height is what I mean. Like, yeah.
No, like,
I guess, like, unless you're Muggsy, that's
sure,
fair.
Like, sure, yeah. If you want to go to the NBA, then
yeah.
height, yes. But
yeah, that's what I mean, yeah.
I don't think in terms of regular, like, high school or even college.
Sure. For
a lot of, like, short people, like, that's, like, Nate Robinson, he was always, like, really fun to watch because he was just, like, so athletic.
Proud over here.
Yeah, he was so athletic running down the court, and just, you don't have to be, but yeah, you have to compensate for that with other
right.
There's a
steeper hill to climb there.
What I'm trying to say is, no one can agree if it's nature versus nurture. I think it's probably a mix of both. Obviously, I think a prodigy is probably mostly nature, and in order for that prodigy to really fulfill their potential, they need parents who are encouraging and supporting them, right? And I think most of the research would agree with that, that yeah, a prodigy is not going to go anywhere if they're not being cultivated and encouraged.
Yeah, that's fair. I think my argument against nature is, like, maybe it's just my jaded political view right now, mm-hmm. but how many idiots out there, and I say this to my fellow Americans, but how many idiot Americans out there are just never going to show the curiosity to learn anything about anything? And it's, you know what I mean? Like, how many voters are willing to accept the stupidest shit or most insane shit without having any, like, you cannot convince those people to take a more active
Well, some people are just learning. Stupid and there's no fixing.
But that's
stupid.
My point. That's my point, right? Like, that phrase exists and I agree with it to some degree. And maybe it was because of how their nurture went to their adulthood lives. But like at some point, I think people become unfixable from that standpoint. that makes sense.
Well, I think that is also, you know, we're kind of going on a tangent here, but I think that too is a little bit tied to age and development. I think nurture is a huge part of that. Like, yes, nature, I think nature is the outlier, but nurture has a big part of that, because if you grow up in such an indoctrinated family, like let's take a look at, I don't know, the extreme like Mormon cults that
they're all over documentaries right now.
Yeah, they're all over documentaries right now. Like that's happening in modern day. And if the society with which you're like in which you're surrounded only teaches you one thing, or you're kind of indoctrinated like Fox News or what have you, especially if you're in an isolated community, and if you don't break out of that isolated community and thought pattern until like your late 20s, I think there's a certain stage at which you may not be able to overcome it.
Yeah. If you haven't been taught, what you're saying is if you never taught how to learn, right? So it goes back to the beginning. We're saying like, if you never learn how to learn, how can you ever escape? Right.
Yeah.
Like you need that curiosity to be able to question whether what you're being told is right.
Yes.
Right.
And then at the, you know, I'm arguing for how important nurture is, but at the same time, our last episode, we talked a little bit about serial killers and
a little bit.
This is where like, I also like, nature is super fundamental to that, because like people are born sociopaths. Like I was having a conversation with someone, like a bunch of research on psychopathy and sociopathy. And yes, there can be like triggering events, but you look at all these stories of psychopaths, sociopaths who they're raised in a family, like their siblings are normal, very nice, loving family. And just from a young age, they were just dark and weird. Like there is no fixing like a certain, it's like being neurodivergent in a certain way, right? Like their brain is wired to not have empathy.
They're torturing animals just to see what happens.
Exactly. Yeah. And like there's no fixing that, because that is nature at its core.
Yeah, I would agree.
So would you like to hear about some child prodigies and feel really bad about yourself and what you have contributed or not contributed to the world at large?
No, because I'm a genius now. So,
did we agree on that?
I thought you don't have to.
I have declared myself as such, and therefore it is true.
I declare genius.
I am a genius. So I'll just go through a couple examples. The first of which is, God, I just wish that I was
just pick
more.
A name. Just make up a name.
Well, it's a name that I'm going to be like butcher.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Make it up.
Okay. Akrit Jaswal.
Sure.
He performed surgery on a burn victim's hands at the age of 7. And he was admitted to an Indian medical university at 12. Then we have William Kamkwamba, who built a wind turbine to power his impoverished Malawian village at the age of 15.
Yeah, but his parents probably helped him with that.
Probably. Probably. What a loser. Please. Please talk to me when you develop 2 wind turbines.
Yeah. Or put Mentos in Diet Coke or something like I did.
Talk to me when you nap until noon and have your parents yelling you to get out of bed because you're lazy. Like a normal teenager. Please. And then we have Gregory Smith, an American who finished elementary school in 1 year and high school in 2 years. He went on to graduate from college at 13 and ended up getting a PhD in mathematics. And he was nominated at 12 years old for a Nobel Peace Prize. And he's been nominated 3 times since.
Yeah, but, you know, Obama got a Nobel Peace Prize, so who cares?
Who cares? So those are just, you know, some brief examples. I'll get into a little more depth here with a couple other stories. So Michael Carney, he mastered the English language basically before he could even walk. And do you remember how old was your son when he said his first words?
Oh, I don't know. Sometime between 1 and 2 years old.
Yeah,
on
like
the
earlier
side of one.
It's usually around 1 is like the average, right?
Something after 1,
So Michael said his first word at 4 months old.
Okay.
Not to make you feel bad or anything.
Well, yeah. I believe it. There's also the part of me that's like, show me the proof. Like, show me the receipts on that one. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, this is a child prodigy. Like,
yeah,
this
no,
kid-
I believe it. But my point is like, you also talk to parents who are like, oh, my kid was saying dada. And I'm like, no, your kid was going this.
Yeah, but I think this is like a little bit different because this kid went on
receipts, that's all I'm saying.
To the University of Southern Alabama in 1992 at the age of 8. He graduated in 2 years at the age of 10 with a degree in anthropology. And he is still to this day in the Guinness Book of World Records as the youngest ever university graduate and has still not been beaten.
What does he do now?
Good question. Anyway, he went on to get 2 master's degrees and a PhD. He won a trivia and game show to get $1 million. And his adult footprint is much smaller and he has disappeared into oblivion, lives a very private life. And his last known whereabouts are Nashville, Tennessee. But I think there is so much clamor and media attention around him as a kid that
he just wants to be
left alone.
Yeah, that's fair.
And, you know, to what you were saying about the parents saying, oh, well, my kid said this. Parents of prodigies actually really struggle because
they can't keep up.
Well, not only can they not keep up, but you really can't relate to other parents. And yeah. It truly is, I'm sure, a challenge to have like one, a kid who's definitely smarter than you and all the things you need to do with it, but you can't relate to anybody. Like, yeah. No one can relate to you. And if you're complaining, like, it's going to seem like you're bragging. So I think the outlet for someone dealing, a parent dealing with that is probably pretty limited.
Yeah. All this tracks with my mom had to deal with me. So
fuck off. The next kid I'll talk about is Laurent Simons. He was he's a now 10-year-old Belgian whiz kid. He was actually poised to be the person to break Michael's university record. And he has an IQ of 145. In 2018, he graduated from high school at the age of 8, so same that Michael did, and he went on to get a degree in electrical engineering at the University of Eindhoven in the Netherlands.
Eindhoven?
He was on track to graduate the 3-year course in 10 months in December of 2019, which was right before his 10th birthday, so he would have, you know, taken on that record, but the university wouldn't allow it because they said... they offered him a 2020 graduation date instead because they said rushing the course would cause his academic development to suffer, and they cautioned against putting too much pressure on a 9-year-old.
Yeah, that's how these kids kill themselves.
His parents withdrew him from university to put him in school in the U.S. because they said, fuck that.
Fuck the parents, in my opinion. Like, it's not that I don't think these kids deserve every opportunity to, like, stretch their intellectual muscles. Like, that's awesome. But they're also 9 and 10. They're still kids,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Like, there's a part of their brain that still is like figuring out how the world works. There's a part of their brain that's still like waiting for their testicles to drop. Like, let them have like real life experiences at the same time, and not just the thing when people say like things like, oh, you're going to do a 3-year course and a 3-year degree in 10 months. It's not just about how smart you are. It's about how much work that is, right? Like, that's a lot of fucking papers you're writing, a lot of tests you're taking, a lot of studying you're doing, even if you're a genius.
Not to brag, but I got my 4-year college degree in 3.5 years. three and a half.
Wow, nice.
Yeah. But no, I mean, that definitely came up throughout the articles is that, yeah, there are, that's a huge point of conflict for people. And some parents, like, they go into it knowing that people are going to scrutinize you no matter what. But a lot of parents expressed, you know, that concern of just, we want our kid, we know our kid is special and we want them to feel stimulated and not bored, but I don't want them to feel like we're pressuring them. And you want them to still have that experience as a kid. But regardless, if you are a prodigy and, you know, whether or not your parents are pushing you or it's all on your own, you're going to move through it probably an accelerated pace, right? Just to some extent.
Yeah,
you probably have to. And as a result, you're probably going to sacrifice some social skills. And one kid, let me see, went on to say that, yeah, once he got into Harvard when he was like 15, it wasn't until his like mid-20s, you know, when he's working, that like it was the first time he'd ever like been met with failure. And because his entire childhood he was just the best. And he said that's when you're unaccustomed to something like failure, which is something most people face in their everyday lives, that's pretty difficult to learn and come to terms with in adulthood.
Yeah, and that goes back to what I was saying earlier about like it's rewarding the effort versus the outcome, right?
Yeah.
At least the parenting stuff talks about today. I had a friend in high school who last couple years of high school, he was basically going to college, because he like tested out of the high school stuff and then he was able to do a program that I think it's called Running Start maybe.
Yeah.
And so he was, so he basically like disappeared from social lives and was doing college classes. And yeah, he graduated quickly from university and all of that. Right. Like, because he had so many college credits already by the time he actually entered college and had formally left high school and all of that.
Yeah.
I don't think it made his life any happier. Like he lost touch with friends and, you know, he got a job at a FANG that he ended up quitting after a couple of years and is now a stay at home dad.
That's like, totally.
Which is great. Like I'm happy to have for him, but like all it gave him was a slightly faster path through college that he gained nothing from a social aspect from.
Right.
Didn't really benefit his career in any way, like other than starting it a little earlier, but also ending it much faster.
Yeah. Right? Almost the exclusive gift is maybe hitting financial security at a younger age.
Yeah. Like,
truly. And I get it is a balance because there were interviews with former child prodigies and some argued both sides. Like some said, yeah, you definitely don't want to push your kid. Others said, you know, it is really important. I'm glad my parents pushed me because like what an I would be really devastated if I hadn't actually continued to practice and hone my skill because had I coasted kind of like what we were talking about at the beginning and just relied on my natural gift, like I wouldn't be where I am today. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's very contextual, very much depends on the person, but it's complicated. Now, I guess I'll end with a quote. A lot of the articles I read and the people I read about are, you know, child prodigies who have gone on to do like pretty amazing things or just find success, maybe not pretty amazing things. Like that's kind of the irony and like the difference, as I mentioned, between prodigy and genius, but they go on to do great things, be very successful. But one article mentioned, you know, child prodigies who've gone on to enjoy the mediocrity of the masses are harder to find. And reason being, you know, there's no support groups dedicated to them.
They're like standing out in a crowd if they're,
And, you know, this person said, you know, just as the prodigies I spoke to all seem to look back on their childhoods with boundless enthusiasm, if you discover an ex-genius now selling home insurance over the phone, it's unlikely they'll be as keen to chat about what once was. And so the baton for ex-child geniuses is carried by people who've gone on to a life of legitimate adult success of their own companies and dedicated Wikipedia pages. That's the pot of gold at the end of the gifted childhood rainbow. But the price of failing to make a smooth transition into adulthood is online oblivion. It's being haunted not by the ghost of what could have been, but the ghost of what used to be. And that's Child Prodigies. Do you have an obscure subculture we should know about or just want to ask us a question? Or do you want to pick my brain because I am both a child prodigy and an adult genius?
Not true.
You can find us on Instagram at Subscurity Podcast and our website is subscurity.com. You can also email us directly at subscurity@gmail.com. Our intro and outro music is the instrumental of We're Better Together by Go Mordecai. Thanks for listening and we'll talk to you next week.